Welcome to the Israel Conversation by the Masa Leadership and Impact Center. We are informally debating issues that concern Zionists about life, culture, and politics in Israel.
Good morning, everybody. This morning, we have a very interesting topic. I'm joined this morning by Kalev. Good morning, Kalev.
Hi, Matthew. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And I am joined by Mike. Good morning, Mike.
How's it going?
It is going. So this morning, we are going to be...
You've identified it as morning many, many times.
I know,
but
three
the listener,
times already. Yeah. It's actually after midday.
Yeah.
And people could be listening at any time of any time of the day or night or afternoon.
I wish you both a good 12:23 p.m. How does that sound?
In which time zone?
The Israel time zone. We are recording here in Jerusalem, which is very nice for us.
On February 13th?
Correct. Lucky for us, not unlucky for us. So we are going to be recording today. We're going to be having a conversation about Israel's policy of containment in a post-October 7th reality in Israel as we are now. Leading up to October 7th, Israel was pretty much using a policy of containment when it came to Hamas. There was some differences in the way that that was implemented from government to government. But I think most people could now say that that was the policy summed up, is a policy of containment. We are going to be discussing this morning whether Israel can continue with that policy in October 7th, bearing in mind the continued threat from the north, from the south, and all points in between. Kalev is going to be arguing for us this morning that containment can work and should be the policy implemented.
And then Mike's going to say we need to hit the Houthis. We'll see.
Hit everybody.
Exactly. So
all we are saying is give containment a chance. That's going to be
me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Without the dulcet tones.
Mm.
So a few things. I think we've actually discussed before about what were the mistakes that led to October 7th, and to what extent were they kind of tactical? Were they an absence of intelligence? Had there been more army units? Had there been fighter helicopters, etc., then would everything have been different? Or was it actually more strategic and it was allowing a genocidal maximalist entity to arm on our doorstep and expecting that we would be able to cope with it? And I actually think that's a different podcast. That is if you haven't listened to it, it's absolutely worth listening to. I think there's a couple of components here. I think there is, should one preempt when an enemy is weak, which in theory was around the kind of 2007, 2008, 2009. Again, just to remind people, Israel withdraws unilaterally from Gaza in 2005. The Palestinian Authority take over. Hamas brutally kick out the Palestinian Authority in, I think...
Kick out from like a 20-story building window.
Yeah, kick out, throw out, kneecap, etc. Many Fatah people end up actually fleeing to Israel. They're very aware who the enemy was. At that stage, could preemption potentially have worked? Very potentially. In 2009, I think it's really the first big war that takes place. Olmert is prime minister. He's about to be replaced by Netanyahu. Netanyahu promises that he's going to destroy Hamas. In 2009, could Israel have gone the whole way and not just kind of mowed the lawn as one of the policies became? Very potentially. And similarly in the north with Hezbollah, I think, you know, after the 2006 war, there's UN Security Resolution 1701. Hezbollah is supposed to be, I think, north of the Litani. So I guess that's kind of 10-ish kilometers from the border. They're not supposed to have any missiles or anything near the border. And over time, Hezbollah kind of slowly returned to the border areas. Could Israel have potentially preempted at that stage when it was beginning to happen? Maybe in the current situation, and I'd say even in the pre, you know, it's terrible to say, but even in the pre-October 7th situation, could or should Israel have preempted Hamas in the south or Hezbollah in the north? I think it would have been very, very difficult. And actually, you know, long-time listeners may know, I don't agree with Netanyahu on a lot of things, a bit of an understatement. But he said something where he said that there wouldn't have been the both public and international support to carry out what Israel is doing now without the disaster of October the 7th. And just, you know, for people's interest, Netanyahu is actually quite conservative. He's actually the opposite of a warmonger. And in one of the previous rounds where people were talking about, should we destroy Hamas, or should we just mow the lawn? And a IDF presentation was leaked to the media and to the public. And the presentation said, in a situation where the IDF are going to take over the Strip, we can expect 500 IDF soldier deaths, which obviously in a pre-October 7th world was absolutely huge. And people aren't sure who leaked it, but people assume it was actually Netanyahu who leaked it because he didn't want to do it. But I think, again, not knowing what we know now, the idea that you would initiate something to take over Gaza that would cause the death of 500 soldiers, again, taking us out of a post-October 7th reality to a pre-October 7th reality, I'm not sure there would have been the public support for it. In fact, I think there wouldn't have been the public support for it, certainly with a controversial government. And if we think about I don't think we need to completely agree with what the international diplomatic community says, but we are reliant in many ways on America and in some ways on others. And if we think about what the diplomatic international response is now to what is happening after all of the terrible things that happened on October the 7th, I'm not convinced that actually we wouldn't have had the political diplomatic room to maneuver had we done these things before October the 7th. Does that mean containment is ideal? I think October 7th shows us that it's not. But I think, again, if you think of the North now, if you bring the IDF there and you every now and then try to create deterrence by attacking Hezbollah whenever they fire missiles, I think that is the preferable policy rather than preempting once an enemy is strong. If we talk about when an enemy is weak, I'm not sure. But I think in the situation of Hamas and Hezbollah, I think that the better policy is containment.
Okay. Thank you, Kalev, for your thoughts. Mike, we would love to hear what you have to say on the topic.
Well, I agree with a lot of what Kalev described in the post-October 7th world. I think not only were Israeli policymakers convinced of that logic, but we as citizens accepted it. And I think that what October 7th did is it completely changed the paradigm. And even now, looking at it retroactively, I think there were people arguing another way, and they made, in retrospect, much more sense. And I think that once we enter the post-October 7th world, then the containment paradigm no longer makes any sense. In other words, as soon as an enemy fires one rocket, that enemy has to go. That enemy has to go. The only thing you get by delaying is their increased capability. And so as soon as they have crossed your border and inflicted harm, that is an enemy that needs to be taken down, especially if it's a non-state entity. If it's a member nation state, then perhaps you can go and try some diplomatic containment in addition. But if you're talking about Hezbollah or you're talking about Hamas or anything remotely like that, or the Houthis, then you're really talking about something that they're not going to listen to by definition. They've unplugged themselves from anything diplomatic. And so once they've launched a rocket, once they've taken an act of war, so they're not only a non-government official organization that has military capability, they are an offensive military non-government entity that is willing to do violence to its neighbors. It's essentially a form of whatever you want to call it, piracy, brigandry, organized crime, call it what you want. But civilization simply can't function with entities like that on Earth. So if they're just talk, if they're just militias that talk, well, let's keep an eye on them. Let's contain them. Once the first rocket crosses the border out into my territory, now that entity has to go. Done. There's nothing to discuss. Because again, the only thing that delaying will do is give them more time to build their capabilities. They've made their intention clear, and now I'm just waiting for their capabilities to increase. Why? All the problems that Kalev mentioned of internal concern, external political pressure, all valid concerns. The only thing is, I don't think a government can morally allow 1,200 of its citizens to be massacred, mutilated, raped, kidnapped. If the price we have to pay to prevent the next round of that is political difficulty within the country and political pressure from outside the country, okay. And if that means our economy takes a hit or whatever the political ramifications are, okay. Okay. And right now, I think you have an Israeli voting public that really understands that. And the fact that that's not totally understood, although largely it is understood and supported by the Western world, largely, certainly by its leaders and by large segments, if not majorities of the population. Okay. Then we'll deal with that, because I would rather deal with that headache and that problem than, you know, wait for the next documentary to come out about what it meant to be gang raped while you were a prisoner in a hole in Gaza. The scale of the conversation has to change. The thinking has to change. October 7th has to be a strategic paradigm shift in dealing with terrorist organizations and entities. And that's it. It's zero tolerance. Zero tolerance. And that requires preemption as soon as they cross the line of committing an act of violence against our interests. And I would advise any country to do the same. I'm not saying that's a specifically Israel issue. I think that the world has to wake up and eliminate these entities from existing.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Kalev. So I took some notes and have a couple of questions. Mm-hmm. Kalev, I'd like to return to you for a second. You were talking about the will of the people and about how pre-October 7th, there wouldn't have been the will to start a conflict or however you want to refer to it. Based on what Mike was just saying, he says the mindset has changed for the country. So do you think now that that mindset change has shifted enough that that would now be tolerated in a future situation?
So it's interesting because Mike and I had another podcast conversation about what to do with Hezbollah in the north, which I also recommend people listen to. And when we were talking a few months ago, we were saying in some ways it's the opportune time. The army's been called up already. There is an awareness of the threat. And the public, who has already suffered so much, is actually willing to go that extra effort. So yes, I think in a post-October 7th world, the public will, political will does exist. And I would even argue that the international will or understanding exists as well. The bigger challenge is, in terms of threat and power, the Houthis are weak. Hezbollah is like an army. Hezbollah in 2006-07 is different to Hezbollah in 2022-2023, and the cost of doing it is immense. Now, you might say, well, the cost of not doing it is immense as well.
Bingo.
But I think if you're going to carry out a war, ideally, it should be as non-controversial as possible. If it's going to take a while and, you know, it's the people's army, you need the people on side. I'd say now we do have that, but beforehand we probably wouldn't. I think you need an army that is trained. Potentially now we have that as well. And I think you need a sympathetic or understanding international arena. I think we have more of that now, although only to a certain extent. There's currently, I don't know when people listen to this, there's currently discussions about the IDF going into Rafah, and the international community is very opposed to it, and Israelis feel that it's essential. So we have it to a certain extent. I do think the public aspect has changed since October the 7th, but the cost of preemptively initiating is sometimes very high. Again, containing also has high costs, but I think
I would argue almost always higher, inevitably higher. As you wait for them to build their capabilities, the price you will pay for the delay will be higher.
And you mentioned Hezbollah in 2007 and Hezbollah today and saying how different they are. So maybe that sort of proves Mike's point.
Yeah, it's not like an army. It is an army that Hezbollah has up north. And so what are we going to wait for? A twice as big army? Like what? So then what are we waiting for? For the army to get bigger? Like will that cost Israeli lives? Will that cost Israeli civilian lives as the rockets start pouring down from the north? Yep. And they're still not engaging in it, partially because they're afraid that they'll lose public support. Well, I think sometimes governments have to commit political suicide. I'll give you an Australian example. There was a mass shooting, I think in the 90s, in Australia, and a right-wing government put together all these gun reform laws, and they lost their base to put all these gun safety laws through the Australian Parliament. It stuck, and then the next election they lost. Okay, well, there hasn't been another mass shooting in Australia since then. And then eventually the winds of change, they come back. Politicians have to get used to the fact that in democracies, sometimes you win and sometimes you lose. You put the needs of the people ahead. I mean, essentially what you're arguing is those, you know, there's always these conspiracy theory rumors that FDR knew about Pearl Harbor and let it happen because that would get the that would break American isolationism. So what you're the consequence of what you're arguing, I fear, Kalev, is that that would be responsible stewardship for a president to say, let them strike and destroy our fleet and kill, you know, hundreds and hundreds of our soldiers and civilians, because that'll get public opinion behind us in a war. I think when it comes to national security, the leaders have to do what's in the interest of the people, and politics has to come second. And I think in a democracy, mustering public opinion is crucial. You have to do your best, but at the end of the day, you have to do what's right. And if that means you lose the election, okay, that's part of being a leader in a democracy. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. And the fact that political leaders in 2024 treat losing as unacceptable, political, get that out of your head. Both sides have to get used to losing sometimes. Every party has to get used to losing sometimes. Losing is part of the work of being a leader in a democracy. And if history proves you right in the end, good for you. You have a legacy. If it doesn't, okay, then you made a mistake and you apologize to the people that you blew it. That's what leadership is. But this, you know, well, if we fight a war in the North now, then the people are going to be upset. You know how upset the people are going to be when the rockets start landing in their preemptive attack? So how's Bibi doing politically now? Because he didn't want to upset the body politic by preempting and destroying Hamas beforehand.
So I think what's interesting here is I think the Hezbollah conversation is the most relevant, because, you know, I joked about the Houthis and there's Iranian militias in Iraq.
Can you explain to me why the Houthis exist on planet Earth in 2024 February?
That's for a different podcast.
It isn't. It is to me unconscionable that this entity is allowed to exist. And if you had told me 20 years ago that there'll be this entity targeting international shipping, and the forces of the West, the mightiest armies in the history of the world, will say, well, we're going to do a careful strike and take out like a building here, that wipe them out. What are you waiting for? What are you waiting for?
So this actually segues us perfectly to the follow-up question I had for you, Mike, which Kalev, feel free to weigh in as well when Mike has had his turn, of course.
I will
is,
weigh in.
You went to great lengths to explain that these are terrorist organizations, that they're not state actors, mm-hmm. that they don't have international recognition as states, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But if we're talking about Hezbollah, if we're talking about the Houthis, if we're talking mm-hmm. about Hamas, we know they have support from a state actor, mm-hmm. namely Iran. Mm-hmm. How should that change? Does that change your policy of
not a
wiping them out?
I was like, if I could jump onto that, because mm-hmm. we've been talking narrowly, in inverted commas, mm-hmm. about containment or preemption against the local actor, mm-hmm. Hamas, Hezbollah, etc. But there's another policy, mm-hmm. which is not to preempt against Hezbollah, but to preempt against the head of the octopus or whatever we're going to call it. That actually to go direct to the sponsor mm-hmm. rather than to hitting mm-hmm. the proxy, which neither of us have actually discussed.
And hit him.
As a, you know, a sovereign state member of the UN,
hit them. What is going to stop them from continuing to do this? Tell me.
But it's interesting that you don't see there's a difference, because you at the beginning you mentioned there was a difference. You made a distinction.
What I'm saying is, with these actors, containment is an old Cold War term for the United States and the Soviet Union. United States policy as its superpower dealing with its foe, the Soviet Union, was containment. We don't want to engage in a hot war because it'll destroy all of human civilization, mutually assured destruction. But through a policy of containment, which is built out of deterrence and incentives for better behavior, we can wait until they collapse. I think the United States was reasonably assured that the Soviet Union wasn't going to take a full military strike against the United States. And so containment was, let's minimize their agenda as much as possible. Here we're dealing with enemies who are explicitly devoted to our destruction. They're committed to it and they're working towards it. We're not dealing, what does it mean?
They're on the border. As in they're physically...
Iran isn't literally on the border, but its forces are.
I'm strengthening your point about the Cold War.
Yeah. So it's a different ball game. You're not dealing with people who, well, now I could argue containment until regime change. Okay. Well, when is that? It's not in my control. And it's not the responsibility of Israeli leadership to wait for the Iranian people to overthrow the government. That's not, they cannot afford to wait for that. And so containment, while it makes sense in the old Cold War United States attitude towards the Soviets, doesn't apply to Iran. Now, we can't, I don't think Israel has the ability to commit real regime change in Iran. I think that has to be up to the Western world. And I don't know what they're waiting for because their interests are being attacked. American troops are being attacked by the Houthis. They're being attacked. And I don't even know why Western media isn't covering the constant battles going on in Iraq between Iranian-sponsored forces and Americans. United States forces are in combat daily with Iranians. Okay, dunzo, dunzo. And why the idea, yes, but if we cross their border, that will escalate. If we hit Hezbollah too hard, yeah, is it not going to escalate if you don't? To treat the Ayatollah like the premier of the Soviet Union is a misunderstanding that the Ayatollah is not the premier of the Soviet Union. It's not. That the head of Hezbollah is not Leonid Brezhnev. You cannot calculate them in the same way. Leonid Brezhnev may have been a committed communist and believe that overall there would be a workers' revolution that would lead the planet towards communism. That's not who Hanan Nasrallah is. That Westerners have trouble understanding a Hamas-like organization. Don't they realize that this is going to end up with Gaza in rubble? Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, they did. They are getting what they wanted. They are very pleased that this is working. Their plan is working. That is who you are dealing with. People who we consider to be irrational, because I don't think they are irrational. I think they have different value systems. They have different ways of weighing things. And so you cannot allow entities like that to function for any length of time and build their capabilities. Take them out at the first opportunity when they first express their toxic, murderous, evil intentions.
Okay, thank you. I mean, I think that was part of the misunderstanding of the conception that we've been referring to, was that some of these organizations are putting their people first, would put prosperity and happiness first, when really what they want to do is see those cities wiped.
Yeah, and sort of the debate today is, is that a lesson learned about Hamas, or is that a lesson learned about evil terrorist entities?
Right. And Kalev, you had a follow-up.
Yeah, so just one thing I would add is that, you know, obviously containment is a bit of a bad word post October 7th.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to think about looking ahead to the north, because it doesn't look like in the near future Israel is going to initiate anything. But I do think there is potentially, I know this sounds weird, there's better containment, as in you can contain temporarily in the north with more IDF troops, with potentially every now and then hitting militarily, trying to put diplomatic pressure, preparing a plan one day, which I would assume actually the IDF have to. I read recently that the IDF knows where Nasrallah is, and they also know that Nasrallah knows that they know.
Mm-hmm.
Reminds me of a Friends episode. Do they know that you know? They know you know. And it wouldn't surprise me if there is a plan for within a couple of hours, taking out the leader, taking out 80% of the missiles, et cetera, et cetera. And it's about waiting for the opportune time to do that. But in the meantime, Hezbollah needs to be contained. And you can potentially contain better than Israel's been doing. But I don't think just because it failed in one area means that it is a poor policy going forward in the near term.
Yeah, but that's essentially accepting my position. In other words, if you're saying just let's delay the preemption till it's optimal for us and then preempt, then you're talking about a very minor containment, a temporary, let's hold them back so that when we preempt, it can be of maximal efficacy with minimal damage to us. Then I agree with that policy.
I mean, what do you think the policy was in Gaza? Was it to contain forever?
Yep.
Every few, contain forever.
They're literally, the Israeli army, and it's the job of every military to have all these war game plans of how are we going to take over. There was literally nothing in the IDF planning for what to do about taking over Gaza. And so that when October 7th happened, they had to make up a plan to invade Gaza. That's what's out in, that's what journalists are reporting. And they're still making it up as they go along. There was no plan to take down Hamas, no matter what they did.
Yeah, I don't agree on a point of fact, because one of us is wrong. I'm confident that in all of the previous rounds, the idea of mituta Hamas, destroying Hamas, was there as an option, which is why they said it will cost you 500 soldiers, and the government never wanted it because
that was a projection. There wasn't a this is out there in the world, in the journalistic world, and we can find the sources. There's difference between assessing what the damage would be and having the operational plan. This unit here, that unit there, then this, then that. The decision to cut it off down the middle, first do Gaza City, then do Khan Yunis, then at the end save, whatchamacallit, where we are now. What's it called?
Rafah.
Till now. That plan didn't exist, according to consistent multiple journalistic entity reports.
And that may also have been part of the failing that we've talked about.
It's
previously.
Clearly a failing. You had to have that plan. Right. What you didn't even have the contingency to respond. Here's why we're only doing containment, because we don't want to lose 500 soldiers, is not a plan for what to do. If your plan, that's not a plan B.
Right. So at this point, I think we will wrap up here. Thank you both of you for joining us. It is the afternoon. It's not the morning. It is true. But thank you both.
We started in the morning. We finished in the afternoon.
Well, we actually met at 12:01. So if we're going to be really punctilious about this. But I would like to thank Mike. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kalev.
Thank you.
And thank you, Ben, as always, for hosting our lively conversations. Thank you.
I like the word punctilious. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Israel Conversation by the Masa Leadership and Impact Center. In everything we do, we hope to connect our fellows to Israel as home, that our Masa fellows will feel at home in Israel and understand more about Israel in all of its diversity. We connect our fellows to Jewish peoplehood, to feel an affinity for Judaism and a sense of belonging to the Jewish people, and the connection is active and meaningful in their lives. And finally, personal development. And in the case of this podcast, our goal is that you'll be able to use the tools and learning for reflection and future development in conversations about Israel and Judaism. If this episode is meaningful to you, please subscribe and share with somebody that you think it will be meaningful to.